Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. This week, our guests are Maria Larionov, Artistic Director of the String Orchestra of the Rockies, and Portland-based novelist Vanessa Veselka. We'll also welcome Nathan Weinbender with a Netflix feature review and hear a bit of C.P.E. Bach's music recorded in our studio back in 2018. Taking us in is some of Papa Sebastian Bach's music played by the String Orchestra of the Rockies. This is Northwest Arts Review. Live performance is a hard-hit victim of the COVID-19 pandemic. Musicians and ensembles continue to find ways to share their art, though, typically in a virtual way. But the String Orchestra of the Rockies, whose new season begins this weekend in Missoula, Montana, will offer public live performances. I talked with Artistic Director Maria Larionov about these performances, the whole season, and more.
First of all, let me say that this is the 36th year that the String Orchestra of the Rockies has been successfully performing in Montana. And as you can imagine, this last summer, we had many, many long discussions with board members and input from musicians. And we really wanted to present live concerts, if at all possible, rather than going the virtual route. So we have put in place a whole list of protocols and safety measures for both musicians and audience that will allow us to do live performances. We're calling our 36th season String Orchestra Reimagined, S-O-R. And for the fall concerts, we are doing chamber music. We'll be playing the beloved Eine kleine Nachtmusik of Mozart, coupled with the Mendelssohn Octet, which is such a joyful and exuberant piece. We thought it would be a wonderful way to get people back in the concert hall. And then in our October concerts, we will be presenting the SOR String Quartet, works of Schubert and Prokofiev. But as you can imagine, it's a lot of changes will be happening. We have the University of Montana Recital Hall, and we will be really restricting the number of audience members that will be allowed so that we can safely distance people. We will be moving people in and out safely. We will be having the musicians, of course, have their individual stand and their individual music, and we will be a little more distanced than we are for our full String Orchestra of the Rockies normal performance.
Right, and each of the performances, as I understand, is limited to 100 audience members. 100 tickets will be sold for each of these.
Yes, exactly, and that allows people to sit in family groups. It allows for spacing between individual people. As you can imagine, the University of Montana already has laid out plans in their recital hall for safely distancing people in that venue. I'll also say we are actually starting off our season officially with a Saturday afternoon outdoor concert at the Bonner Park Bandshell, and that will be a free concert. It will be, I think, a nice event that families could come to. We'll have the Big Dipper ice cream there as available as well, and it might be just a nice way to have people come and enjoy music in an outdoor setting if they are hesitant to come inside for our indoor concert.
What will you be playing for the outdoor concert?
It's the same program.
Same program, okay.
The Mozart, Mendelssohn. And, you know, I chose those works because, first, they're both very just enjoyable, comfortable, I like to call comfort music.
Mm-hmm.
They're works that are very audience-friendly. They're full of energy. They're full of positivity. And it just feels like the right kind of music to be opening the door and moving forward to performances again. As you can imagine, all of us have at the most been doing maybe virtual performances, but we haven't been out in front of a live audience for months, which mm-hmm. feels very strange as a professional musician.
What is your take on the sense of preparedness and how that is affected by the very, very limited number of performance opportunities that are out there right about now? What you're thinking about how that affects ensembles, ensemble sound?
Wow, that's a great question, Jim. I like that question. I would have to give it a lot of thought. I have to say, as a musician, speaking for myself, we spend our whole lives practicing. I practice whether or not I have an upcoming performance. Mm-hmm. And I feel that there's something wrong in my day if I haven't played my scales and my technique. And it just feels like part of me is missing when I don't do that. So mm-hmm. the actual keeping my fingers in shape and keeping the chops up, I think all musicians do that.
Mm-hmm.
I find what goes down is the intense concentration that's required when you go in front of an audience. It's a level of concentration that is above and beyond the practice room level. And that I wonder what that's going to feel like after not being in front of a live audience for a while. I think there will have to be definitely an adjustment because of the spacing that's required.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, we're a conductorless orchestra, so we rely on visuals and physical motions from each other
mm-hmm.
to see how we're going to play together. And I will be really interested to see, you know, how that works for us. There will be probably a little bit of anxiety at first as we, you know, adapt to knowing what we're doing and mm-hmm. looking at an audience in the hall that is not sitting right next to each other, but sitting spaced apart. I mean, that reality will be with us. But my feeling, what usually happens is as a musician, when we start playing as a group, we forget about the other things and we're in the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that will transmit, that energy will transmit to the audience as well.
Maria also shared what she is hearing from orchestra colleagues around the country.
I think orchestras are getting very creative. I know, for example, friends in the New York Phil tell me that they have the smaller ensembles, but they've postponed the whole orchestra until mid-season.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the LA Phil, they've divided the orchestra into thirds, and they're doing performances with one-third of the orchestra spaced apart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So orchestras are getting very creative. Our SOR season is 4 weekends spaced throughout the season. So it's not a primary job for any of us. It is something that we all look forward to 4 times a year. We did move our April concert, which will be April 2021. It was moved over from April 2020, and that's Stephanie Chase, who graciously agreed to come and perform a year later. We have been talking to the soloist whom we originally booked for this coming September, November, and February to see if they would also move one season out.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and nobody is surprised when they get that phone call asking to move a year out.
Oh, right. This is a completely different world in terms of just the planning for concerts. And, of
mm-hmm.
course, that includes the folks who travel around as soloists. Their itineraries have been just scattered to the four winds. Maria Larionov, thank you so much for being with us and giving us an insight into the brave new world that the SOR, among others, is facing these days. And all our best to you for a wonderful, wonderful season.
Thanks, Jim. I appreciate it.
Much more on the String Orchestra of the Rockies, including their performance schedule, is available at their website, sormt.org. Project Power, now streaming on Netflix, imagines a world where a street drug gives temporary superpowers to anyone who takes it. Nathan Weinbender takes a look at the new big-budget thriller, which bogs down a terrific premise with mostly predictable action.
The drug comes in a tiny metallic-looking capsule that has a cyclone of colored light swirling inside it. If you swallow the pill, one of two things will happen. Either you'll be briefly imbued with a superpower, or you'll die instantly. Taking the drug, which has the street name Power, is obviously a gamble, but enough people have gone all in because now it's an epidemic. I'm sure you can already tell that the new Netflix thriller Project Power is built upon a fairly obvious metaphor, though it's way less concerned with the world of drug addiction than it is special effects. The outcome of ingesting a dose of power is like spinning a wheel of infinite CGI possibilities. One guy transforms into the Human Torch. Another becomes a chameleon, blending into whatever he's standing in front of. Yet another turns into a hulking giant. Of course, there's a catch. There always is. If the drug works for you, you have exactly 5 minutes before the effect wears off, which explains why everyone in the movie wears a stopwatch. That's not necessarily ideal for the characters, who sometimes have to swallow handfuls of the pill at a time in order to prolong the reaction, but it is super convenient for the average Hollywood screenwriter, who needs an easy dramatic loophole and so devises an arbitrary 5-minute time limit. The film is set in an alternate version of New Orleans, and it introduces us to a tough teenager named Robin, played by the very good Dominique Fishback, who takes care of her ill mother and deals power on the side. One of her customers is a cop named Frank, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who discovers that the drug makes him bulletproof, which is a big plus for a cop. Just as you start to wonder how the department could be so oblivious to his inexplicable invincibility, the captain of his precinct, played by Courtney B. Vance, gets wise and places him on leave. Frank is drawn back into the criminal world when he starts receiving weird messages from Robin, who's being chased by a tough guy played by Jamie Foxx. It turns out this dude, named Art, was once a test subject for the original government-produced batch of power, and his daughter somehow inherited superhuman powers from him. Now she's been kidnapped as the drug pusher's new guinea pig, and Art knows that Robin could lead him to the drug source, so they zip around the city with Frank in pursuit. This setup is terrific, and it suggests limitless potential. And speaking of, there was a 2011 movie called Limitless, also about a miracle drug that intensified normal human capabilities, that I kept flashing back to. I'd say Project Power is a smidge better than that earlier film, but it suffers from a similar problem. Its basic premise is so good, and yet it sputters out before it's over. About an hour into Project Power, the plot downshifts into bland action, with a bloody finale set on a tanker ship that goes on for way, way too long. The script is also grasping at social consciousness without ever really dealing with it. Characters have conversations about the racial disparity between those who peddle power and those who die from it, and the name of Henrietta Lacks, the black woman whose genetic information was given to cancer researchers without her consent, is mentioned in passing. The filmmakers are using these complex issues as buzzwords, not actual substance. Project Power was directed by Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman, who got their start with the documentary Catfish, and whose most recent feature was Nerve, another alarmist, neon-colored contemporary allegory. They have a good sense of space and visual style, and they do know how to stage an action sequence in unusual ways. For instance, Art takes out a room full of goons, but the camera is stuck inside a cryogenic chamber that's gradually freezing over. If they're given the keys to a sequel, I hope they go deeper into the implications of the premise, rather than falling back on a slam-bang finale that we've seen a million times before. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Nathan Weinbender.
Nathan Weinbender is film and music editor for The Inlander and a film critic on Spokane Public Radio's Movies 101, heard Friday evenings at 6:30 on KPBX and Saturday afternoons at 1 on KSFC. Here's a little Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach interlude from our KPBX studio, recorded back in 2018 with flutist Jennifer Slaughter and pianist Melody Poehler. Flutist Jennifer Slaughter and pianist Melody Poehler, recorded in our KPBX performance studio in 2018 and heard now on Northwest Arts Review, also available as a podcast from SpokanePublicRadio.org.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. My guest today is Vanessa Veselka. She's the author of the novel Zazen, which won the Penn Robert Bingham Prize for Debut Fiction. Her new novel is The Great Offshore Grounds, a sweeping story of family drama tackling social status, love, death, femininity, American greed and mythology, the current state of the U.S. healthcare system, sky-high rents, and the struggle to get by. She'll be doing a virtual event in partnership with Auntie's Bookstore and the Spokesman Review on September 15th. Vanessa, thanks for joining me.
No, thanks for having me.
Just start with this story traverses a lot of physical space. The characters sort of go back and forth on road trips across the country a couple of times, but it's very much rooted in the Northwest, which I think is something our listeners will appreciate. Was it important to you to ground the story in this geographic area?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, because I've been out here for so long, but also because I feel like in literature, a lot of times, and particularly with this book, I would run into people who would read it and they would either say, oh, I know these characters, and I don't see them in books much, or they would say, these characters are totally illegible to me. I have no idea what motivates them. And I began to see a real difference between the East Coast and the West Coast. So it made me feel that there really are a lot of sort of characters and personalities that haven't really come forward in, in our literary world as much as they could. And I definitely think the Pacific Northwest is one of those places.
Let's talk about the characters a little bit. This novel is centered around a family, but it's very much an unconventional family. And there's a pair of sisters at the center of the novel. So what can you tell us about those sisters?
Well, Cheyenne and Livy are the same age. They're both 33 when the book starts. And they were born into, as you said, it's an unconventional family. There were two women who were in an open relationship with this one man, and both got pregnant, but only one wanted children, so the other took both. And the sisters have never known which mother belonged to which girl. And so part of the story is that they get the name of the other mother and start on this trip to try to find her. But the personalities of the two sisters are very, very different. What they want out of life is very, very different. You know, Cheyenne is somebody who every instinct and impulse she has, she pretty much acts on, you know, and so she's kind of a train wreck. The other sister is much more internal, not shy, just kind of private, and work ethic is the most important thing to her. Her sense of autonomy, her sense of independence, her sense of not needing anybody, of not being in debt, you know. And she is, the novel starts when she's just been able to afford her apartment by herself and is very financially fragile.
So having set that up a little bit, can you read a little bit for us, a section that maybe introduces those characters?
Yeah, I'm going to read a section that also just has to do with Eastern Washington. So it's called The Great American Desert. This is when Cheyenne and Livy have figured out how to, through a series of events and small theft, how they to get a rental car and try to go find this woman. Cheyenne and Livy left in the evening, heading east through the pass. The late spring rains had fallen as snow in the mountains, which, plowed to the shoulder, turned the road into a gray gully as they climbed. Slush froze, giving grip to the wheels. Slopes flashed white. Livy had flat out refused to buy chains for a rental, so the car skated on the glassier sections of ice. She remained hyper alert, because it only takes one trucker jacked up on crank. She reached for a thermos of coffee. It wasn't dread, but another thing entirely that had her. This was what she wanted this trip. A way to get Cheyenne moving and see if the momentum would inspire her to go somewhere else. Not a plan so much as an instinct about how her sister worked. But now that they were in motion, all she felt was the loss of control. Dropping in elevation, they drove through the lowland pines to the highway, ran straight. It was so bright in the full moon, they could have driven without headlights. Livy pulled over to the side of the road to pee. Mud starred with ice crystals glinted in the moonlight beneath her. The sky was a giant bowl above. When she got back in the car, Cheyenne was eating a bag of corn nuts that Livy had stashed in the door well on her side. Livy gunned the engine as she pulled out, but it only buzzed. Watching the road over the dash, they came into the high desert. The gold haze light, the towns that turned out not to be towns, but gas stations, with an outbuilding or a closed rest area lit by state funding. Soon the highway rose in a steady incline as they approached the Columbia, which cut down through the basalt cliffs and man-made lake above the dam, a new body of water, born under the pressure of great plans, azure in the daylight and easily seen from space, spanned by a bridge, the lake's surface rippling in the wind that whistled through the canyons etched with petroglyphs. Wordless in the moonlight, they crossed the flooded lands, the sedge houses of the Wanapum under the current, a shelter for fish. Cheyenne dozed. She tried to get one leg tucked under her, but kept hitting the stick shift. At least they weren't fighting. She felt 60. Maybe it was already too late for anything real to change. Thinking that, Cheyenne felt her lower back ache. Too many aspirations. She was getting her period soon and hoped it wasn't that. The added hormonal stress in a car, on a long drive with her sister, that could blow everything apart.
That was my guest, Vanessa Veselka, reading from her new novel, The Great Offshore Grounds. So I'm glad you read that section because Eastern Washington. I think a lot of our listeners will know exactly what section of the drive you're talking about on that, and have had many similar experiences of going over the pass. And also, I think that section gives a good idea of the beautiful descriptions in your novel of, you know, the physical landscape and, you know, the surroundings around this character's contrasted with the very gritty, or in other ways not beautiful, interactions that are happening with the characters. So was that juxtaposition intentional on your part, or did it just come organically from sort of setting the story in this landscape?
I never set it up consciously to be in juxtaposition. And I think that the role of history and of place in this novel is very, very important to the whole novel, in the sense that, you know, I write about, in many ways, about the American project, and does it work, and what could it be, and what is it, and how do you grapple with it? And so at a narrative level, the impulse of that kind of narration is, it's sort of a relentless press of both history that you cannot be extricated from and beauty that has nothing to do with you.
Mm. Well, as I noted, you're doing an event with Auntie's Bookstore in the Spokesman Review on Tuesday the 15th. What's it been like trying to promote a new novel in a pandemic with all of these virtual events? What can people expect on Tuesday night?
Well, I personally, as somebody who has done a million road trips myself, was so disappointed to not be able to actually physically go do the tours I wanted to do. However, this event is actually very unique because, you know, I had the initial sort of launch events, but then we decided, let's do the road trips that are in the book. Actually, the Aunties and the Spokesman Review, the Northwest Passages Book Club event, is the kickoff to the road trips event. We decided to make that the kickoff because it's Spokane. So that is going to be unique in its own way. And every one of them has been unique. I've been really, really fortunate that way.
My guest has been Vanessa Veselka, author of the new novel, The Great Offshore Grounds. She'll be doing a virtual event as part of her virtual road trip on Tuesday, September 15th at 7 p.m. with Auntie's Bookstore and the Spokesman Review. Vanessa, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me.
No, thank you. It's a lovely honor.
Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Chevenin. Help today came from Chris Massini. Thanks as well to Maria Larionoff, Vanessa Veselka, Jennifer Slaughter, Melody Puller, and Nathan Weinbender. The String Orchestra of the Rockies takes us out. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.